The oldest man I ever knew was also the most cynical man I've ever known. And when he was 95 years old, Les Radley said to me, I don't like New York City, but it's my favorite place to get lost in. If you take out the words New York City from Radley's comment and put instead the word consciousness, Radley's statement still makes perfect sense. In my own study of New York City, I would say that I get more lost, and being lost is a really beautiful feeling here in New York City, because to be lost in the big city is to actually be quite precise about your place in the universe. My cousin Bruce watched September 11th occur with his own eyes on a rooftop on Avenue B in the East Village. He said that when the towers collapsed, he realized most of all that the vastness of the sky had been that much more exposed, and that the towers had reemerged, reunited with the infinitude that is the sky above us every day. The World Trade Centers did not die. They created more space. And we may be lost, but that's because that disorientation is life.
Hello, and welcome to another installment of the Sea Realm Podcast. I am your host, KMO, and this is episode number 275, 9/11 turns 10. Prepared for release onto the World Wide Web on Wednesday, September 14th, 2011. In this installment of the podcast, I will be playing two different interviews for you. The first is an interview that I recorded with Mark Rabinowitz. Mark is probably the most clear-thinking person that I have spoken to in terms of the competing 9/11 conspiracy theories. Some of them are worth paying attention to, others not so much. And guess which ones the mainstream media glom onto. The second interview is one that Olga Kay recorded with her friend Kevin Ryder. And a lot of people exhibited a lot of generosity and bravery and goodwill on September 11th, 2001, and in the days and weeks following it. But Kevin's story is, at least in my experience, unique. He did something really worthwhile, and even though he didn't achieve his stated objective in any clear and identifiable way, I think that his effort was still worthwhile. And it is certainly a welcome departure from the tired themes that got drilled into my head as I drove around on Sunday listening to NPR's special coverage of the 9/11 10 years later day. Ugh, please. Anyway, I don't have a lot of room to chat here at the beginning of the episode, so let me thank the generous sponsors to this week's episode of the Sea Realm Podcast. First, let me thank the people who clicked on the PayPal donate button, either at SeaRealm.com or SeaRealmPodcast.podomatic.com. Those people are Matthew M. and Brian R., so thank you very much to Matthew and Brian. Also, I want to thank Ray B. and Paul H. Ray and Paul have both volunteered to work behind the scenes on the Sea Realm website, and they both did some very unglamorous but also equally necessary work on the back end to make sure that the Sea Realm archive is available to anybody who cares to download it from SeaRealm.com. And this comes at a time when the Podomatic archive has been trimmed back to the barest essentials. There's just over 20 episodes available on Podomatic, so if you're wondering where all the other episodes are, go to c-realm.com and think of Ray and Paul when you see the beautiful sight. Also, think of Justin and Jamie, the two people most responsible for the renewed and revitalized Sea Realm website. Also, I want to thank Olga Kay. Not only did she record an interview and send it to me, she recorded a total of three interviews. The other two will not be in this episode, but I will be putting out a supplemental episode this week that includes all of the interview material that she recorded, and that will be available both on the Internet Archive and on SeaRealm.com, but it will not be on Podomatic. The music this week is by the Transpersonals. The song is called You Gotta Horus Out of Control. And Horus is H-O-R-U-S. There's no W in it. You've Got a Horus Out of Control by the Transpersonals. That'll be in the middle. It's a rockin' selection. And now to introduce my conversation with Mark Rabinowitz, I want to play something that I recorded for the 9/11 show in 2009. This is with military historian Gwyn Dyer, and Gwyn is explaining why he does not believe in any sort of 9/11 conspiracy theory, even the let it happen theory. So here's Gwyn Dyer, recorded in 2009, and then we will hear from Mark Rabinowitz.
The results of an action should not be taken to indicate why, who did it and why. You know, I mean, because major actions generally have far more side effects than they do direct and intended effects. 9/11 being a very good case in point. 9/11 was very good for the Bush administration, for the security state, for the military-industrial complex, and for, as you say, despots and dictators everywhere. Yes, of course. Doesn't mean they planned it. Yeah. I mean, they know how to hitch a ride in any passing vehicle. That's one of the great arts in Washington, is find a passing subject and hitch your wagon to it. But the idea that, okay, here's why all the conspiracy theories really don't fly. Even what you might call the little conspiracy theory, which is that the U.S. government knew it was going to happen, 9/11, but let it happen. Not the grand conspiracy theory where the U.S. made it happen, because that would require at least 1,000 people, some of them willing to kill themselves at the behest of the U.S. government, and none of them ever willing to speak afterwards, not even after the divorce, sitting drunk in the bar, broke, but able to make a few million dollars if you just spill the beans, the famous book, you know. Never mind the grand conspiracy theory, the little one. The U.S. intelligence services get the information, and now they decide to sit on it. Okay, it's not going to be the intelligence services who sit on it. They're not the decision makers. So in comes these bits of information. You know, a bunch of Arabs trying to learn airplanes here, but they don't seem interested in landing. You know, that sort of thing. And the intelligence analysts in one or more of the 15 U.S. intelligence services, you do have a lot, go through the usual incoming data, and they begin to see patterns. And so what happens? Well, the low-level analyst who originally spots the pattern goes to her section boss or his and says, look, I think we have something here. Of course, a lot of false positives in intelligence work, but this could be real. Have you anything else pointing in the same direction? Well, the boss kicks the thing upstairs to the head of the CIA, the DIA, whatever it may be, who gets in touch with other intelligence agencies and queries that, you know, have you got anything pointing in this direction? FBI says, yeah, we've got something here. National Security and the NSA says, we've got something here. Okay. There's a conspiracy to attack the United States. We have the information. We now go to the National Security Council. And there they are in glamorous array. It's the Secretary of State, who had been Colin Powell in those days, and his assistant. There will be the Secretary of Defense and his assistant. There will be the National Security Advisor and her assistant, this being Condi Rice at that point. There will be the head of all the intelligence services, and there will be the heads of the military services. Okay, now you have to imagine that Condi Rice, who's the National Security Council, National Security Advisor, is chairing this meeting. Oh, and the Vice President, he's there too, Dick. And she says, look, we've got this intelligence about a forthcoming attack by Islamist terrorists on the United States. I propose that we take no action on this, because the consequences for our agenda of allowing those strikes to go ahead in New York and Washington will be enormously beneficial. We all should move our offices to the south side of the Pentagon, however. Okay? Now, she says that, and they all go, uh-huh, good idea, Condi. And nobody gets up on the excuse of going to the bathroom and goes into the loo and gets on the mobile and says, I've got a bunch of crazies in there who are proposing to kill thousands of Americans. This is high treason, and it is mass murder, and I don't want to be part of it. I'm blowing the whistle now. Because if you don't blow the whistle now, you're part of the conspiracy. Now, what I'm asking is, did nobody leave the room? Did they all say, good idea, Condi? The soldiers, the heads of the intelligence? I don't think that happened somehow.
You're listening to the Sea Realm podcast with your host, KMO.
That was Gwyn Dyer, who was on this program in 2009 for the annual 9/11 episode. And now to have a critical look at Gwyn's arguments, I have on the line Mark Rabinowitz. Mark was a participant in the early days of the 9/11 truth movement, and he is a longtime analyst and commenter on the topic of peak oil, which Sea Realm listeners will be quite familiar with. Mark Rabinowitz, welcome to the Sea Realm podcast.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Now, we just heard Gwyn Dyer talking about how unlikely even the sort of let it happen conspiracy or inside job narrative really is. What did you think as you were listening to Gwyn's analysis?
Well, the biggest problem with his argument was his estimate that you would need thousands of people to be willing co-participants in a Levin on purpose scenario. And I find that rather disappointing for someone as well-informed as he is. By their definition, covert operations are compartmentalized, and many people could easily participate in a small part of the story without knowing the full picture. So the idea that you would need thousands and thousands of people to misplace warnings, to suppress evidence that the attacks were coming, it's anyone's guess how many people would need to be involved. One of the few estimates I've seen that I think makes some sense is in Michael Rupert's book, Crossing the Rubicon, where he estimates that perhaps 24 people would have had to be fully informed, which makes a conspiracy to allow the attacks to happen more credible. But more important is the well-documented evidence that perhaps 15 countries provided very specific warnings to the White House in the summer before 9/11. These include Britain, France, Germany, Israel, Jordan, Morocco, Egypt, Russia, and other countries with close ties to the United States. And some of these warnings were extremely specific about what was about to happen, who was going to do it, where it would be, and when it would be. And these pieces of evidence were mostly in mainstream media coverage, but the media does not want to connect the dots to show that there was full foreknowledge that the attacks were about to happen.
In the annual 9/11 episode, I've come to approach it with some trepidation because it's really hard to get into it without risking seeming like a real fool or a zealot or somebody who is overly credulous. And Douglas Rushkoff wrote a piece about that, basically arguing that we should just leave this topic alone. And part of his argument was the idea that there are powers that deliberately muddy the water by feeding false information to people who would be leaders in the truth movement. And the idea that there is something so sort of cloak and dagger going on and that that is evidence that we should just ignore it seemed really bizarre to me.
Well, this is standard operating procedure for dealing with many great scandals. It's one of the ways that public skepticism over the official story of the Kennedy assassination was turned from a political justice movement into a freak show. And the same thing happened with the 9/11 so-called truth movement, where in the early days, most of the people involved were piecing together the facts of how warnings that it was about to happen were suppressed, and now you have almost a contest on the internet to see who can come up with the wildest theory of what happened, regardless of whether there's actually any evidence for it. And most of that is probably sincere, but one of my favorite hoaxes of 9/11 is the false claim that a plane supposedly did not crash into the Pentagon. And that was first created by Donald Rumsfeld, defense secretary, a month after the attacks. And I don't think anyone needs to question his lack of sincerity. And this sort of disinformation is a great distraction, and it allows the media to focus on things that they know are obviously not true, instead of asking, well, why was the CIA conducting a plane into building exercise near Dulles Airport at the same time that the planes went off course? That was in Associated Press. The CIA itself admitted that. And there was no mention of it in the 9/11 Commission report. So it's much more fun for the media to focus on people who claim that missiles were fired at the buildings or that Cheney's people bombed the World Trade Center, rather than focusing on things that actually have evidence for them.
On your website, you have a PDF that folks can look at. And in fact, I posted it to the Friends of the CROM group. And on it, there is a continuum of different 9/11 narratives, going from the official story on the far left to disinformation that discredits the truth movement on the far right. And in the middle, you have a zone of proven beyond reasonable doubt assertions, things like very specific warnings from U.S. allies, as you've mentioned, were suppressed, or FBI officials undermined agents investigating flight schools before 9/11. There are other things, though, that you list as being probably not true and probably not very good avenues for investigation. And actually, World Trade Center 7 is in the probably not true category. And in fact, it was World Trade Center 7, just the video footage of it falling and looking so much like a controlled demolition, that really made me suspicious of the mainstream story.
Well, and it is very suspicious. But I also recommend watching the video, which got much less attention, of a piece of the World Trade Center falling onto Building 7 and gouging a 20-story hole on the south side of the building. Now, I am not a structural engineer, and I'm not going to pretend to be one on the Internet, but I think the truth movement made a huge mistake focusing on the collapse of the buildings when the firefighters in New York are on record saying that they watched the two towers and Building 7 leaning before they fell down. And I wasn't in New York that day, but what I find much more interesting is how the media wants to completely paint this as a physical evidence argument and completely ignoring the suppressed warnings that the attacks were coming and the overlapping war game exercises that were on a day that confused the air defense response. That is a productive argument that could have been used to get some progress on this, but of course that's not what happened, and that's not where the truth movement is these days. For a lot of people who suspect complicity at some level, if it turns out that the demolition theories are not true, then that is most of what is marketed as 9/11 truth. So therefore, the demolition argument becomes the essence of the case rather than a distraction. And that's why the media focuses most of their attention on the demolition argument rather than mentioning the war game exercises simulating similar events to 9/11 as 9/11 was underway.
Something that provides me with a bit of friction mentally when it comes to the 9/11 issue is that, as you point out on your website, some of the loudest voices in the 9/11 truth movement claim that peak oil is not real and is merely a contrived justification for oil company profits and aggression against countries in the Middle East.
Well, it's both, because peak oil is the reason for the aggression against Iraq in particular and other countries, Libya probably to an extent now too. But geology is not subject to politics. And, you know, I'm sure you're aware there's arguments over the exact amount of oil that remains in the ground in the major oil fields of the world, and we'll see which geologist turns out to be the most correct. But the Earth is not getting any bigger. And regardless of which geologist is proven correct, peak oil is a fact. You know, you can't burn oil more than once. And we are now about 3 years past global peak oil. We know that Cheney was on record talking about peak oil before he was made vice president. And without the shock and awe of 9/11, there is no way that the Bush administration would have been able to invade Iraq and grab the oil. And it's not to make more money, because these people have more money than they know what to do with. It's to control the fuel supply of the industrial world as we enter the downslope of Hubbert's curve. You also have the problem of a lot of peak oil experts not wanting to get into the fact that 9/11 was allowed to happen in order to grab the oil. In the first few months of the Bush administration, I was wondering publicly what their response was going to be to peak oil, because I was reading Colin Campbell and energycrisis.org and other of the early peak oil efforts and thinking, well, if I know about peak oil, obviously the Bush administration, they're oil men, they know about peak oil, what are they going to do about it? And then on 9/11, I went, oh, that's what they're going to do about it.
For you, it's no stretch whatsoever to say that 9/11 was the Bush administration response to peak oil?
I think the full argument on that is a longer thing than we have time for today. Some of it is summarized on my site, oilempire.us, www.oilempire.us. But the whole, I mean, look at the false argument that Iraq supposedly was behind 9/11, which the Bush administration played coy with. At times they implied it. At times they said, oh, no, that's not really true. But their first cabinet meeting after they stole the White House in 2000 was about how we're going to grab Iraq. And the reason they grabbed Iraq is that was the second largest supply of oil. It wasn't because Saddam Hussein was an evil man, although he was. It's like the bank robber Willie Sutton, who was asked, why do you rob banks? And he said, that's where the money is. Well, Iraq is where the oil is. And maybe it's not turned out quite the way they were hoping for, but we still have our bases there, and the U.S. is not planning to abandon those bases, certainly not where the oil is. And surrounding Iraq, you have the oil fields of Iran and Saudi Arabia concentrated in a very small area. That is the single largest fossil fuel reserve on the planet. And we have our military forces there. Oh, and to do that, you know, if the Bush team had gone on TV and said, my fellow Americans, the oil is in decline, we're going to have to grab the oil militarily, there would have been some people who supported that. But there's no way they could have pulled it off the same way. And every war requires some sort of deception. Even World War II, to get the United States involved. The Roosevelt administration knew Pearl Harbor was coming. They had cracked the Japanese code, and they kept the warnings that it was about to happen to a very small circle in the top leadership. It was terrible for the people on the ground, and there were about as many people killed on Pearl Harbor as in 9/11, but they knew it was coming. It's not that unusual in history for deceptions to be used to trigger war. It's actually normal for deceptions to be used to trigger war.
You know, every now and again, somebody will write to me and they'll say, KMO, I really dig what you do in the Sea Realm, although I'm surprised you didn't know that oil is produced by geological processes deep in the ground and that oil fields that have once been depleted will refill themselves. This is the abiotic oil theory. And so many people that I've encountered, they phrase it just like that. They assume that I'm not familiar with the theory because I haven't embraced it. If I'd heard it, it would be so self-evident that I would immediately champion it.
Well, abiotic oil is kind of like the abiotic oil is to geology as creationism is to biology. Yes, it's true that oil fields do have some refilling after they've been depleted, but that's mostly because the surrounding oil in the rock flows into the gap created when oil is extracted. And the chemistry of oil shows it comes from fossil plants. Now, it's theoretically possible. There are a few drops here and there that were made from other processes. But the real issue with oil supplies is the rate that you can extract them out of the ground, not, you know, if there's so-called abiotic oil sitting somewhere that is being kept secret by the evil oil companies. It's the rate of flow. And I'm in Oregon. And in Oregon, we don't have any oil. We have volcanic rock that's almost the entire geology of the state. And no one's ever found commercial quantities of oil anywhere in Oregon because we have the wrong geology. We have a lot of basalt. We have volcanoes. We have a few places where you could tap geothermal energy, but we don't have any petroleum. And to me, apart from the scientific analysis, that alone debunks abiotic oil for me.
You think that if the abiotic oil theory had any validity, then places where you have volcanic activity, you would also have oil?
Yes. And abiotic oil is basically an internet campaign at this point to try to sow confusion and keep people from focusing on the real issue of peak oil, which is not the pointless argument over how much is left, but how are communities going to respond to it? How are we going to use the rest of the oil? You know, I'm using solar electric power to talk to you right now. It's powering my telephone and my laptop computer. But it took oil to move the solar panels across time zones from the factory where they were made to my house. If we're going to put up a billion wind turbines, that takes a lot of oil and coal to make the electronics and the steel and minerals, you know, peak minerals. We could have a conversation on that. If we're going to relocalize food production so that as the fossil fuels go away, people still have food to eat, well, that takes a considerable amount of coordination and energy. That's the conversation that needs to be happening on a local and global scale, not arguments from people who don't have a scientific understanding of oil, who think that the oil companies are secretly hiding trillions of barrels of reserves because they want to run the world, as if they don't already run the world.
I think something else that a lot of people who would be peak oil skeptics don't really take into account is that oil companies don't seem to be investing in new refinery infrastructure in the American South along the Gulf Coast. And you would think that they would need to do that if the supply of oil were virtually endless.
Well, there's no point in building more refineries if you're at peak oil or near peak oil. And it's for the same reason that a lot of the oil companies had been merging and cutting out their middle management. If the supply of oil is going to go into terminal decline, you don't need all these middle management people. And as the oil dwindles, he who controls the last bit of the oil will have more power than they even do now. And this is not about making more money. It's about controlling the world economy and controlling where food can be grown. And, you know, people who already have billions of dollars, giving them a few more billions of dollars that's not the concern. It's about power, not about profit. Again, the real issue is how communities are going to respond to the inevitable decline of the fossil fuels, not just oil, but all the others, because we could use the remaining oil as a bridge to a relocalized future, or we could waste it all on more freeways and Walmart culture and warmongering, so that when the oil's gone, we'd have nothing left to show for it.
Well, I agree. I think that the question of what are we going to do with our rapidly diminishing oil is a lot more important than the question of what exactly happened on September 11th, 2001.
Well, but we have to understand, for me, the transition to a relocalized, powered-down communities everywhere requires the converting of the military-industrial complex for peaceful purposes. And that is why what happened on September 11 is of critical importance to understand, not because I think there's going to be a new investigation, but we have to understand more from a truth and reconciliation perspective that the empire does not want to decentralize political power. It does not want to have world peace so that communities can relocalize production.
Mark Rabinowitz, I thank you very much for your contribution to the Sea Realm podcast.
Thank you for the invitation. And again, the website is oilempire.us, www.oilempire.us.
And the Sea Realm listeners know that I will post a link to that in the show notes for this episode, which they can find at kmo.livejournal.com and at searealm.com.
One week at a time.
You are listening to the Sea Realm, and my name is Olga Kay, and I am with my friend Kevin Ryder. We are in an undisclosed, mysterious Manhattan location where Ryder teaches yoga class, and we're talking about 9/11 and the Twin Towers. And you have a very interesting story to tell. Take it away.
Well, the beginning started normal enough for anybody who was living downtown. I heard the first plane go past, heard a little crash, thought I would ride my bicycle down to see what the crash was, then thought a little more and said, maybe I'll go up to the terrace upstairs and take a look. And when I saw that hole in the building, I said, you're not going anywhere. And not long after, second plane came in, and I was like, okay. The world has changed. And I had been several years before over in Pakistan, up in the Himalayas and the Karakoram, to do research for a trek. So I knew Pakistan, and I'd known about Bin Laden for a few years, since the late 90s. So I put two and two together pretty quickly, and there was really nothing I could really do of that much for that much help after 9/11. So I quickly got a visa for Pakistan because I thought they might stop issuing visas for Pakistan. And I was already growing a light beard, so I let the beard continue to grow. And at the end of September, I flew off with my mountain bike to Islamabad, Pakistan. And I'd ridden a bike over there before. I knew the people over there, had a good feeling for it. And I said, it's going to be a little different. If it's bad, you just come back. But it wasn't bad. It was fascinating. And the thing I found out pretty quickly is that, as many things in our news are, we don't get all the news we think we should get or that we'd like to get, the same thing was happening in Pakistan. For instance, I met the firemen in Peshawar, right along the Pakistan-Afghan border, and I was talking to them about the firemen in New York. And it was very funny because they had some old fire engines from like 1920, 1930, you know. But these are modern Pakistanis. And I told them how many firemen we'd lost. And they were shocked. They had no idea, you know. And they started to talk among themselves in Pashto, and they said...
Which you understand fluently.
No. I mean, they talked among themselves, and then they said to me in English, we want you, when you go back, to tell our brothers in New York that we are thinking of them. And so Just a little incident like that sort of changed everything. So the idea was just to go over there and see what was going on, talk to people, because now was the time to talk. I thought the bombing was a little much. You know, we had to do something, but the way we were going about it was not the proper way. So I just thought, some human contact. And then... I went to the hospital in Hyderabad, just outside Peshawar. It's between Peshawar and the Afghan border, where they were bringing any Afghan civilians who were wounded. If the people had enough money, they could make it across the border and to this hospital. And I met the head of the hospital, whose name I better not give, because we're still good friends. We bonded very quickly. And we were together all the time, and I saw some of the people who had been injured by our cluster bombs. I'd never seen injuries from a cluster bomb before, and it was pretty ugly. So they had expected a lot of casualties. And luckily, because I guess our bombing was minimal or pretty efficient, they had many less casualties than they thought. So that was a very good thing. And I met the doctor's son. And his son had never had any but bad impressions about Americans, since we got along very well. And all of a sudden, his world was different, you know. So there's just little things like that. Every day there was always something that happened. And then one day I was going to the news conferences. I was watching the international news conferences at the Taliban embassy in Islamabad. And I saw the questions that were being asked, and they were silly questions, you know. And I said, well, if they can ask silly questions, I can ask a silly question. Because what had happened during the period of time that I was over there, you remember Ramadan was approaching and Christmas pretty much coinciding. And there was talk in America about us not, or stopping, taking a break over Christmas and Ramadan, taking a break in the bombing, you know?
And, isn't that nice?
Yeah. And I said, well, that's a good idea, you know? And just to sort of stand back, you know, and reevaluate. So originally... You know, Bush had demanded Osama his head right now, right? And the Taliban reacted with, the reaction was a counteroffer, because that's the way you do things over there. There is nothing black and white. You make an offer, you make a counteroffer, you know, it's horse trading.
You haggle.
All the time. Haggle, I mean, no matter what. So the Taliban says, well, we'll give him to a neutral Islamic power and let them try it. And we said, absolutely no way. And so when we were over there, when I was over there, this stuff was in the air about maybe stopping bombing at Christmas. So I said, well, maybe I'll go talk to the Taliban ambassador, see if I can get in. And surprisingly enough, with my New York driver's license, you know, they vetted me a couple times, you know, through a couple different people. And there was no weapons check. There was nothing. I could have been carrying a bomb, anything, and nothing, you know. They just looked in your eyes. They sort of looked in your eyes and looked down to the soles of your feet and sort of looked deep inside. And then they said... Okay. And then you got past to the next person. He interviewed. Okay. And it was all male. And they were very courteous, very nice, courteous people. And of course, you didn't see any women. You know, I mean, the men were very courteous, but no women existed, essentially. And so finally, I got in to see Zaif, the ambassador, because I knew he spoke English because I'd seen him interviewed before. He would hear the questions in English on TV because he gave an interview every day, and then his interpreter would explain the questions exactly so he would get the exact translation, but I could see he understood English. So I said, well, I can go talk to him. So I got into the office and introduced myself. I said, I'm a New Yorker from downtown. I live about, a baseball field away, a cricket field away from the World Trade Center. And I said, just came to talk, you know? What's going on? And he said, well, what do you do? Or he said, we were a little surprised. I said, you were surprised? He says, yes, we had no idea this was coming. I said, this has sort of messed up your plans, hasn't it? He says, you bet it has, you know. Now we've got America, you know, bombing us. We've got, you know. And I said, well, listen, there's something has happened in the last couple of weeks. You probably know of it, that this offer has been made, or this idea is in the air anyway, that we may stop bombing, you know. So I said, you're in a very unique position. The Americans rebuffed your counteroffer. I said, you're in a position now, you can make a counteroffer to your own counteroffer, right? You can say to the Americans, we will stop, we will give up Osama to you if you stop bombing. We'll give him up because he's a guest. I mean, I know you have the Pashtun belief in guests. You have to honor your guests. You can't give him up. But you're in a real strait, you know. And if you give him up, if the Americans will stop bombing, that would be the deal. Is it going to cause less trouble for you? And he said, He says, what do you do in New York?
Yeah.
And I said, I'm a yoga teacher. And he says, what is yoga? You know? So I explained a little bit. And then, like an idiot, I ran through a few sun salutations. And he looked at me like, you're from Mars, you know. And then, but he was still very simpatico. I mean, he was very patient, you know. And then I said, well, it would be like Sufism in Islam. Not even realizing at the moment that they hate the Sufis. The Taliban hate the Sufis as much as they hate everybody else. So I said it would be like it's a philosophy and leading towards mystical states, towards elevated states of consciousness. And he's like, okay. So so he took my idea, you know, and he said, yours is a good idea. He says, I make no decisions. He says, We have a courier that goes every day to Kandahar. They make all the decisions in Kandahar. He says, if you'll type this up, you know, it'll be delivered to Kandahar, you know. And I said, look, you don't have to patronize me. You know, I said, I just came into here. I mean, I didn't have any thought about this until I came, but it seemed like, you know, something to talk about, and I wanted to see who we're dealing with, you know. And he says, no, it's a good idea. And it, you type it, bring it, and it will be delivered, you know. So I said, okay, thank you. Oh, we're having tea and cookies, you know. And so I went to the computer place, came back the next day. They didn't even check me this time. They just shuffle me in, you know. And we sit down, and he reads the proposal, and we're having tea and cookies again. And he says, I was thinking about your proposition, you know. He says, I don't believe the Americans would stop bombing even if we gave up Osama. He says, I just don't believe it. And I said, well, now you have a window of opportunity. I said, in 3 months? Not much of a window, you know, because I'm sure your soldiers are very brave. You fought the Soviet Union. You defeated the Soviet Union. But the Americans are fighting from 30,000 feet. How are you going to fight somebody from 30,000 feet, you know? In 3 months, you could well all be dead, you know. So you've got the chance. And so we shook hands and parted, and that was that. But so I had meant to ask that question at a news conference, and because I saw these other people asking questions, you know, which were useless, and I thought, well, I could at least put this out hypothetically. Like, there's been a rumor that you may give up Osama if the Americans stop bombing. Well, I didn't do it thinking I would do it the next day. Well, it turned out that news conference was the last one he had because the Americans had protested that he was using the news conferences as propaganda. So there's a rule, you can't do that. So that was his last news conference. So I lost my chance, but I got my say in. And so I continued to ride. I'd ride out. I'd go past the checkpoints on the way to the Afghan border that said, no foreigners pass this point. Absolutely no foreigners pass this point. And I just kept riding. And then I'm riding along the Afghan border. And it's obvious there's nobody guarding the border. You know, people are coming back and forth. Taliban, they're obvious Talibans, you know, going back and forth. And I go back to Islamabad, or to Peshawar, and I'm telling the international reporters, I said, you know, there's nobody along the frontier, you know. We say we're protecting. They said, no, the army's going to do that. I said, I was riding my bike. There's nobody there. And so anyway, that was just a couple weeks, memorable weeks. And I wish I'd spent longer because there was so much to see and hear. And a lot of the reports that I was reading in the New York Times and the Washington Post, a lot of those reporters were living out at the 5-star hotel. I was in the middle of the old city, and I was hearing completely different things and getting an entirely different feeling, you know. And so it was just an interesting time. And I've gone back twice since then. And it's always been fascinating.
You spoke a little bit about the journalists and what difficulties they were having over there as far as reporting.
The journalists, they have to sell their stories to their editors. You know, they have to convince the editors that they're worthwhile. And I remember there were a couple people who had stories about the Northern Alliance, who was our ally in the fight. And they were, unfortunately for the reporters, stories that sort of cast a doubtful light on the Northern Alliance, like there'd been some child prostitution involving little boys, and there were several other stories like that. And their editors in New York said, we don't want stories like that now. At this time, only positive stories. So they were a little frustrated, but they knew the game. This is part of their job, you know. So they just continued to do stories, and they did as much as they could, you know. But it's funny seeing them out at the 5-star hotel, you know, and then...
their green zone.
Yeah. Yeah, and then the feeling on the streets in the downtown was completely different, you know? So I'm like, this is the impression that the world is getting is from these people who are in this little green zone, you know?
Were there any reporters down in the old...
There were a few. I mean, they'd come in, but they'd get pretty scared pretty quickly, you know? And then I remember there was one person who... I knew this person's name, and somehow somebody told me that she was... I said she, so you know it's a she now. She was going to be changing money at this money changer. And so I went into the money changer, and I said, has this person been in? Is she coming in? And he said, yeah, you can meet her at this time. Now, he didn't know me at all. This is a Pakistani. And he just told me that this woman is going to be there changing money. This is in a climate of fear. I mean, I could have been anybody. I could have been an assassin. So a few hours later, he was out in the street, and he saw me. And he said, my friend, forget everything I told you. He says, I'm sure you're fine, but he would really be betraying that woman, this reporter, if she knew that, if I came up to her and said, oh, yeah, your buddy told me you were going to be here, you know, she would feel like, what the heck is going on? So I didn't get to meet her, but I met a lot of other people, and it was fascinating. And the hotel where they were staying at in Islamabad, which was eventually bombed several years later, even then you could see, my God, it would be so easy to get in there to bomb this place, you know? And eventually the Taliban came in, or Al-Qaeda, whoever it was, and bombed the place, destroyed it pretty much, you know? So every day was fascinating. You know, the individual people, I had yet to meet an individual person over there who, when I said where I came from, and I never denied where I came from, I always said I was from downtown New York, they said, the reaction was always, it was horrible what happened in New York. And they were sincere. And then the following comment was always, and you have no business bombing Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. And I said, that's why I'm here to talk, you know, to meet people, to talk.
And, self-appointed ambassador.
Well, it was, I'd been over there. Like, I wouldn't go to the Congo because I'd never been to the Congo, right? I wouldn't be to the Balkans because I'd never been to the Balkans, you know? But I've been going to India and Pakistan for years, and so I had some feeling in the neighborhood and knew some people there, so it felt like, Of course. Mm-hmm. This is the center of the world right now. The center of the world is no longer downtown Manhattan. It's transferred over to that part of the world. And I like to be in the midst of things see things with my own eyes, you know?
Sure. Did that interest in that world inform your knowledge about bin Laden? And as you said, what he was up to?
Well, I knew before. I'd read his stuff, and I was before 9/11, and I said, we've picked kind of a serious enemy. I mean, and he's picked us. We've kind of picked each other, you know? And it bears watching, you know? Because he's a serious, studious, meditative type, you know, who's committed to his cause. And when this happened, when I saw the plane, the first plane, I thought, uh-oh. And then the second plane, I was like, okay, well, that's it for sure, you know? And so it felt like a natural thing to go over there. I mean, I felt no sympathy with his methods at all, obviously. But no, it didn't really increase my knowledge of him. It just sort of brought history into America. All of a sudden, we are part of history. And continues to get more fascinating.
And you returned to the disaster zone.
Yeah, I came back. And
I don't think they were letting people in.
Well, I could get in because I lived down there, so I had an ID, so I had to keep on going past all these police checkpoints all the time, which got real annoying. And so I would just blow them off after a while. I was like, they're going to have to shoot me, because if I do this every day, you know, I'm going to kill somebody. and even in the immediate after of 9/11, when they had everything blocked off, immediately afterwards, I stayed at the building as long as I could. Then I had to evacuate, but I snuck back in around all the security when they weren't letting anybody in three or four times to bring in friends to see, and then to bring in photographers to photograph from our building.
That's great.
And just to see what was going on, because I felt this is where things are going on, and I have really bad allergies to dust, so I wasn't
that
inclined to go down to the pile. And
you lived close enough.
So the safest place seemed like Peshawar, Pakistan,
yeah.
You know, and the place where I could do the most good, because the places where I was teaching yoga, everything was closed. I teach at a lot of different places and they were all closed. And so there was nothing I could do for teaching. So I said, well, it's my time to go over there and listen and see for myself what's going on. Sort of just be a witness to what's going on and see what happens. And it was fantastic. Every day was a little revelation. The fireman, the doctor, the kids, you know. And the Taliban, surprisingly enough. I mean, I was surprised that I didn't hate him when I met him. What I saw was really just frightened men. I mean, they were just scared to death. They were putting on a good front, but you could see underneath they were like shaken, you know, because this had messed up their whole plan. I mean, if 9/11 hadn't happened, they would be ruling Afghanistan and there would be no problem. They would have their Sharia law. They would be, you know, smacking women's ankles. They would be doing exactly what they wanted. And all of a sudden their world had gotten shaken up. Right. And they were trying to put on a good front, like, but it was the mask was falling, you know, so that was interesting, you know.
Right.
And it was almost like the guys were very friendly. You could imagine even going having a beer, but of course they don't drink beer, so, you know.
Non-alcoholic.
And but it was a fascinating time, yeah.
You're listening to the Sea Realm podcast. Turn on, tune in, and take heart.
That was the lovely Olga Kay interviewing her friend Kevin Ryder. And what if every American saw and thought of the Taliban as a bunch of misdirected but ultimately scared and likable people who you would go and have a beer with if they would drink beer with you, and who would probably be really excellent hosts if you were ever to visit their home, rather than as abstract, anonymous evildoers whom the manufacturers of consent would have us direct our rage and our thirst for vengeance if we let them? And other than that little bit, I don't have any rant prepared for the end of this episode, nor do I intend to embark on a spontaneous rant, so those of you who are expecting one can now evince either disappointment or relief. What I do have are some announcements and an email. So let me get to the announcements as quickly as I can, and then I can slow down and take on that email, which was a lot of fun. Actually, not an email, but a message left on my live journal.
First, I want to tell you about the Edible Ecosystems Emerging workshop that's coming up. The full title is Edible Ecosystems Emerging Food Forestry for the 21st Century, a 9-day intensive forest garden design training with Edible Forest Gardens author Dave Jackie and friends. You've heard Dave Jackie and his co-author on that book, Eric Tonesmeyer, on this podcast before, if you've been listening for a while. This event is being put on by Spiral Ridge Permaculture Gardens and The Farm here in Summertown, Tennessee. It will run September 23rd through October 2nd, 2011. And the poster that I'm looking at reads, "Dive deeply into the vision, theory, and practice of creating resilient, productive food forests modeled after temperate, deciduous woodlands. Learn to design edible ecosystems through lectures, site walks, experiential exercises, and design projects. Inspire and empower yourself to start food forests for you and your friends, neighbors, and clients." The tuition is on a sliding scale. It ranges from $1,100 to $1,400. It includes food, lodging, and tuition. Need a scholarship? I would encourage you to inquire. You can write to spiralridgepermaculture@gmail.com or go to www.spiralridgepermaculture.com. And if that seems like too much to type, of course, you know, you can find a link to it in the show notes for this episode on kmo.livejournal.com or crealm.com. And if you want to send me email, my email address is kmo@crealm.com. That's the letter C as in consciousness, and then a dash, and then R-E-A-L-M, crealm.com. Or you can post to the Friends of the Sea Realm group on Facebook, or to any entry that I've made on LiveJournal or Twitter. Or you can now comment directly on the crealm.com website. Thanks to Justin and Jamie once again for all their work on the crealm website. The other event that I wanted to tell you about is the Horizons Perspectives on Psychedelic Conference. It's going to take place October 14th through the 16th in New York City. And I will be there along with Olga Kay. We will be recording interviews for this podcast and rubbing elbows with the psychedelic luminaries of our age and hopefully with crealm listeners. I always enjoy meeting crealm listeners, so I hope to see some of you there, meet some of you there, hang out, enjoy libation and good company. So if you think you might be interested in going, I would encourage you to post something about it to the Friends of the crealm group on Facebook. Next week's show will feature the long-anticipated return. Well, actually, not that long, because he was on the program just this summer. But John Michael Greer will be back. Olga Kay and I drove to Cumberland, Maryland, where we recorded an interview with John Michael Greer face-to-face. Parts of that interview have been lost, but the remaining bits will be on next week's episode. It is episode number 276. And now I think I've got just enough time left to read this message that was left on LiveJournal. It concerns my interview with Charles Eisenstein. The message reads as follows. Aloha from Puna, Hawaii. A friend sent your podcast URL my way, and I've been delighted to listen to a couple of episodes. Efforts like yours to encourage dialogue, particularly among people worth listening to, is edifying to say the least. Thanks. However, and I'm sure this is the part that causes you to cringe, as I stand out on my hand-carved, off-grid little piece of semi-subsistence living, upon hearing the rap, with a seemingly straight face, of reptilian overlords, well, suffice to say, I'm compelled to write and express my confusion at your entirely inaccessible riff. Although I've tried to grok David Icke's rap, if he's indeed the guy who perpetuates it, I just come away thinking, why on earth did this seemingly very erudite, sensible man just slip into some shtick about shape-shifting reptiles? Anyway, sorry to tap into the area that I assume troubles you. Nevertheless, in your very worthwhile and much-needed role as educator, I think that for the sake of epistemological integrity or whatnot, some of your audience, well, me anyway, would appreciate either fleshing that one out or just taking ownership of the indigestion that the notion causes. Keep up the good work, Darren. Well, Darren, if you listen to the 270-plus hours of crealm podcast that is available on the internet, you will hear probably about 15 minutes worth of conversation in that 270-plus hours about the reptilian overlords. So I don't have a lot more to say on the topic than has been said so far, so let me just say, yes, I absolutely take ownership of the psychic indigestion that the talk of reptilian overlords causes in you and me and anybody else who hears it. Well, that Ending Rooster Crow is just seconds away, so let me thank you all for listening to this episode, encourage you to join me next week, and until that time, I do hope that you will stay well.